Module 4 is Leveraging Technology and Insurance. This covers Chapter 4 in the textbook, so let's go ahead and get out our study sheet. And as you can see, we're going to talk about different methods of risk treatment. We've already talked about risk identification. We've talked about risk analysis. Now we're going to be talking about treating risks. We'll also focus on different methods of risk transfer, such as insurance and some non-insurance methods. We'll start off, though, by talking about fundamentals of risk treatment, and then we'll talk about the evolution of risk treatment and how technology has affected risk treatment. We'll discuss risk treatment applications to the different risk quadrants that we discussed earlier in this course. We'll talk about treating risk with insurance and non-insurance risk transfer as well, and then we'll wrap up by discussing large deductible plans. Let's start off by talking about the fundamentals of risk treatment. Earlier in this course, we discussed risk identification and risk analysis. Combined, those two represent risk assessment, and the identification and analysis of risk really don't mean very much unless we can come up with effective ways to treat the various risks that we've identified and analyzed. So let's go through different risk treatment plans and the whole concept of risk treatment itself. Risk treatment is the implementation of techniques to manage or mitigate risks. The goal of risk treatment is to select options that best help the organization achieve its strategic objectives. We'll talk about the different options. It could be that we choose to avoid the risk or modify the risk. We have to select the best risk treatment technique or techniques. Risk treatment entails examining each risk treatment option, must determine if each option leads to a tolerable level of residual risk. Residual risk is the level of risk remaining after actions are taken to alter the risk. For example, let's say that there's the risk that my house is going to be subject to a fire, and so I go out and purchase homeowner's insurance, but I've got a $5,000 deductible. The residual risk there is the $5,000. That's the risk that I'm still subject to. That's the risk that I've retained. That's my residual risk. And there needs to be a tolerable level of residual risk for the organization. Keep in mind that the various risk treatment techniques we're about to talk about, they're not mutually exclusive. In fact, some treatment plans call for the use of multiple types of techniques. So we might see some combination of techniques used to treat one or several risks. Risk treatment techniques apply to the four quadrants that we talked about of risks: hazard risk, operational risk, financial, and strategic risks. The techniques, they vary by industry, the size of the organization, and risks faced. Later on in this module, we'll go through briefly different ways of treating the risks in the four quadrants, and we actually have a separate module for each of the four risk quadrants coming up in this course. There are five common techniques for treating risk. We're going to go through each one of them, and we'll be talking about them a lot going forward. The first method of treating risks is risk avoidance, avoiding the risk. Avoiding is stopping the activity or never undertaking the activity. This is a risk control technique, avoidance. If we avoid the risk, the possibility of future loss is eliminated. Of course, the possibility of future gain is also eliminated, and in many cases, risk avoidance is not practical. Let's say that I own a restaurant, and I'm concerned that someone's going to slip and fall in my restaurant and sue me. If I want to completely eliminate that risk, I can just close down the restaurant and go out of business. That's risk avoidance. That'll certainly prevent that type of risk from ever happening. However, if I shut down the restaurant, I don't make money anymore. So that's not a feasible option. But this is, once again, one type of risk treatment technique. The second type of risk treatment technique is transfer. This is sharing or moving the risk. Essentially, what's happening is an organization is transferring the risk to a third party. Oftentimes, that's done through the use of insurance. If an organization purchases insurance, the risk is being transferred to the insurance company. It could also involve outsourcing a risk to a contractor as well. So we have avoidance, we have risk transfer. A third technique is to modify the risk. That increases or decreases the likelihood of an event. There are a couple of different ways to modify the risk. You need to be familiar with loss prevention and loss reduction. Loss prevention is a risk control technique that reduces the frequency of loss, such as installing a theft prevention system in our office building. That's a type of loss prevention. It reduces the frequency of loss. Loss reduction is a risk control technique that reduces the severity of the loss. And an example there is installing a sprinkler system in our building. If there's a fire, we'll probably still have a loss if there is a fire in the building, but with a sprinkler system, hopefully the fire will get put out pretty quickly and it will reduce the severity of the loss. So that's modification. Modification's a risk control technique. We also have retain or retention. That's accepting the consequences of risk. In other words, I'm not going to do anything to try and treat the risk. I'll just accept it and I'll be subject to that risk. For example, if I own a house and I purchase no insurance on the house, I've retained the risk. This is accepting the consequences of risk. It may be used in conjunction with other techniques. If I purchase insurance on my home with a $5,000 deductible, the insurance represents risk transfer, and the $5,000 deductible represents risk retention. So I'm actually employing two risk treatment techniques with that particular insurance policy. And the last technique is exploiting the risk. This is a technique that's different than the other four techniques because the other four techniques are focused on losses. Exploiting the risk is taking actions to maximize expected gains. This could include adding a new product or a new service. Keep in mind, though, when I add new products or new services, that may result in additional risks. And those risks, of course, have to be identified, analyzed, and possibly treated. So how do we treat risk? How do we determine what the best course of action is? There are several approaches. One relatively straightforward approach that you do need to know for your exam is the Prouty approach. The Prouty approach can be used to select a risk treatment technique. It considers four categories of loss frequency and three categories of loss severity or impact. It considers both low and high severity losses, and it helps risk management professionals prioritize loss exposures. Risk managers can chart on a matrix where a risk would fall based on the frequency and impact of the risk. With your course materials, with the study guide, you do have a handout that came with it, and at the top it says Prouty Matrix. Let's go ahead and take that out now and take a look at it. And as you can see, the Prouty Matrix handout has, on the left, three rows, and the rows represent loss severity, and we have severe, significant, and slight. And we have the columns that represent the loss probability, and we have almost no chance, almost nil, slight chance, moderate chance, and definite loss. And based on this matrix, we can determine possibly the best way to treat each individual risk. For example, if we have a risk that has almost no chance of happening, and the severity is slight, we're probably not going to worry about that at all. We should just go ahead and retain that type of risk. However, if we have a risk that's definite and severe, we want to avoid that risk, don't we? Some of these other treatment techniques include transfer or modify. For example, if we've got a risk that there's almost no chance, but if it does happen, it's going to be a severe loss, in that case, we might want to consider transferring the risk. Maybe we get insurance. If we have a moderate chance of the risk happening, and let's say it's severe loss severity, then we want to modify the risk as well. I don't think you need to necessarily memorize every single one of these boxes in the matrix, but you may want to know the types of losses that should be avoided, types of losses that should be retained. And certainly you should understand what the Prouty matrix is, what the Prouty approach is. Once an organization selects a risk treatment technique, a plan must be developed. And the plan outlines how the organization will implement and monitor the selected technique. The elements of an effective treatment plan include the following: an explanation of the technique, proposed actions. We want to document the actions proposed and how they will be prioritized. Resource requirements. We want to identify the resources necessary to carry out the risk treatment. Roles and responsibilities, the timeline, and the monitoring requirements. So we need to have a plan in place to treat risks. Let's do a practice question. The risk control technique that reduces the frequency of a particular loss is known as, and we've got loss prevention, loss reduction, risk transfer, and risk retention. Well, we know it's not risk transfer because we're looking for a risk control technique, and we have risk control and risk transfer. Those are different things. So we know it's not risk transfer. And something that reduces the frequency of a loss is called loss prevention. Loss prevention reduces the frequency of a particular loss. Loss reduction reduces the severity of a loss, so B is false. Our answer is loss prevention. A is the answer. Let's talk about the evolution of risk treatment and some ways that technology has impacted risk treatment. To achieve its strategic objectives, every organization needs to find ways to pay for its losses, pay for its risks, and pay for its risk treatment plans. Risk financing involves paying for losses or risk treatment plans. It's about financing risk, and it involves the transfer or retention of risk. It's a form of risk treatment. Risk financing must be part of every organization's holistic risk management strategy. The more risks that are retained, and by the way, risk retention is a type of risk financing. Retaining the risk assumes that the company is willing to pay for that risk. The more risks retained, the more funds that are needed to finance those risks. And those funds are used to apply risk treatments, which include avoidance, modification, transfer, and retention. Let's talk a little bit about technology's impact on risk modification. In the past, risk management focused on the causes of past losses. Advances in technology have caused risk management to be more forward-looking. We've discussed this a couple of times already in this course. Large data sets about past events allow organizations to identify patterns of risk and predict risk. In some cases, risks can be predicted so accurately that they can be modified to where they're completely preventable. Let's say, for example, that we have a distributor of frozen foods, and they run the risk that their freezers will stop working in the middle of the night when nobody's around to fix them. What they could do is they can install temperature sensors in the freezers that would automatically activate a backup generator if the temperature started rising to a certain level in the freezers, and that could prevent losses. That could also help lower the organization's insurance. Technology has also impacted risk transfer. We mentioned earlier that risk transfer is the transfer of risk to a third party, and that often involves the purchase of insurance. Risk transfer has been affected by technology in various ways. For example, insurers can now combine big data with artificial intelligence and machine learning to predict and plan for risk. And by using artificial intelligence and real-time data, insurers can push product offers to potential customers that are specifically tailored to the customer's needs. There's the development of alternate products that's occurred because of technology. Insurers can price insurance more precisely because of technology. and premiums and applications can be collected electronically. Technology has also had an impact on financial transactions. It's speeding up the recouping of losses. Smart contracts initiate a loss payment as soon as the contract parameters are reached. Let's say that we have a manufacturer that's in a flood zone, and weather reports have indicated, sensors have indicated, that the building has suffered some flood damage. A smart contract can automatically issue a claim payment without having to have a third party involved. So smart contracts can speed up the payment of losses. Blockchain can be the infrastructure upon which smart contracts are implemented. The verification of coverage and payment could be completed within seconds as opposed to days or weeks. So let's do a practice question. Which one of the following is a benefit for insurers that the use of smart contracts can provide? Smart contracts can improve an insurer's public perception. Smart contracts really aren't designed to improve public perception. They can speed up the payment of losses, make things more efficient, but really they're not designed to improve public perception, so A is false. Smart contracts can completely prevent some categories of risk. They don't prevent categories of risk. They could just facilitate payments. So B is false. Smart contracts can dramatically increase the speed of premium payments. Not the speed of premium payments, the speed of loss payments. So C is false. D, smart contracts can reduce administrative costs. Absolutely, that's true. D is our answer. Let's apply the different risk treatment methods that we've discussed to the risk quadrants that we discussed. Once a risk has been identified and analyzed, a risk treatment technique must be selected. The risk quadrant the risk falls into may determine which treatment is best. And if you remember, the four quadrants are hazard risk, operational risk, financial risk, and strategic risk. And we're going to go through each one of these and apply the different risk treatment methods to each one. The first one is hazard risk. Let's say that we have a company that plans to manufacture a new product with small parts that are a choking hazard. Let's say it's a toy manufacturer that wants to produce a new toy, but there are small parts to the toy, and that could lead to someone choking, and that could lead to a large product liability claim. What could this toy company do? Let's look at the five treatment methods here. Remember, we had avoid, modify, transfer, retain, and exploit. Let's take a look. The first thing that company can do is avoid the risk. In other words, decide not to manufacture the new toy. That would be a good idea if the potential liability claims would outweigh the potential revenue of the new line of toys. So that's risk avoidance. That may be a practical approach. They could instead modify the risk. What they could do is redesign the product with fewer small parts. That is loss prevention. Remember, loss prevention lowers the frequency of a loss, and having fewer small parts would result in fewer choking incidents. So that's modifying the risk. They could transfer the risk. The toy company could purchase products liability insurance. The company could choose to retain the risk, and that doesn't mean do nothing. What that means is potentially buy insurance with a deductible. The deductible is going to be the amount of risk retained. So the company would need to see how much of a deductible it could tolerate. So that's retaining the risk. That would be, for example, insurance with a deductible. Alternatively, the company could exploit the risk. Produce a product that's not offered by competitors and corner the market with that particular product. These are all different treatment methods, and probably what the company would do is select among a couple of these. So that's for treating hazard risk. Let's talk about treating operational risk. Let's say that we have a company that stores confidential customer data, names, addresses, social security numbers, other confidential data. The company faces a large data security risk. If that data security is breached, that could lead to reputational damage for the company and a loss of customers. So what could they do? First of all, they could avoid the risk and decide not to store the data. That probably isn't very practical, just not storing any customer data at all. But that is, of course, one option, avoiding the risk. They could modify the risk. There are a couple of ways that they could do that. One is upgrading data security, or they could duplicate the data. Duplication is a risk control technique. You do need to know that for your exam. That's where we duplicate the exposure units. In other words, having a backup of the customer data. That way, if the original customer data was breached, there would be a backup. We could have separation of the data. That disperses assets over several locations. That would be, for example, storing customer data on several servers instead of storing it all on one server. This way, if one server is breached, at least the data on the other servers would be unaffected. Separation could be a good method of modifying that risk. They could transfer the risk. There is cyber insurance that could be purchased. They could retain the risk by just simply not purchasing insurance or having insurance with a deductible. Or they could exploit the risk by collecting more data and gaining a bigger competitive advantage. So those are some ways of treating operational risk. We also have financial risk. What are some ways we could treat that? Let's say that we have a financial institution like a bank that makes loans to customers. What's the bank's risk? The bank's risk is that the customers will default on those loans. That's credit risk. So what could the bank do? They could avoid the risk by deciding not to provide loans to customers. Or maybe what they could do is say, we're only going to provide loans to customers if they've been in business for 5 years or more. But to an extent, they are doing some avoidance of risk by not offering loans to customers in business less than 5 years. So risk avoidance is one possibility. They could modify the risk. They can alter their underwriting guidelines, maybe providing loans only to businesses with great credit ratings. That's loss frequency. Or they could reduce the dollar amount of the loans. That would be loss reduction. They could transfer the risk by using derivative securities and hedging strategies. There are different hedging strategies we'll talk about later that could help transfer the risk to a third party. They could retain the risk, just retain the loans. Maybe the company, the bank, has decided that even at a default rate of 5%, the company will be okay. So they could retain the risk and do nothing. Or they could exploit the risk and become a preferred partner to small businesses by giving them a loan initially and then maintaining that relationship as the business grows and grows. And that way they have a customer for life. So those are some ways of treating financial risk. And then finally, we have ways of treating strategic risk. Let's say that a company is thinking about entering a foreign market and there's some risk there that when they try and sell their product in the foreign market, it just won't sell. What are some ways to treat that? Of course, they could avoid the risk and just decide not to enter into that foreign market. They could also modify the risk, and they could modify the risk through diversification. Let's go ahead and highlight diversification. Diversification could reduce severity of failure in the new market, and that involves releasing the product in several new markets, not just one. They could retain the risk, or they could exploit the risk by establishing a foothold in the new market. You notice that risk transfer is not included with strategic risks because generally strategic risks cannot be transferred. Let's do a practice question. Harlem & Associates is a large accounting firm undergoing a risk management assessment. The risk manager is particularly concerned with making sure none of their data is at risk of being lost. Which one of the following risk control techniques is best suited for this situation? It does say that we want to make sure none of the data is at risk of being lost, and we could do duplication, separation, diversification, or risk transfer. When it comes to data, the best way of ensuring that none of it's going to be lost is through duplication, having backups. So A is our answer. Let's talk about treating risk with insurance. Insurance is a key component of most risk financing plans, and insurance is often the best technique for losses with high severity and low frequency. Let's highlight that, high severity and low frequency. In order for a loss exposure to be ideally insurable, it has to meet six characteristics. Let's go through each one of those characteristics and then we'll talk about each one individually. The first one is that the loss exposure has to represent pure risk. Remember, we said in module one that for a loss to be insurable, it has to be pure risk, objective risk, and diversifiable risk, POD. So when we're talking about loss exposures being ideally insurable, it has to represent pure risk, like a fire, not speculative risk. Also, it has to be a fortuitous loss. In other words, an accidental loss. The loss must be measurable and definite. A fire would definitely result in a measurable and definite loss. There has to be a large number of exposure units. The loss must be independent and not catastrophic. And the premiums have to be affordable, otherwise nobody would purchase the insurance. These are the six characteristics that represent an ideally insurable loss exposure. Even if the actual loss exposure does not satisfy all six of their characteristics, it still could be an insurable loss exposure. It's just not an ideally insurable loss exposure. So we might still be able to get insurance even though our loss exposure doesn't satisfy all six of these characteristics. Let's go through each one of the characteristics. The first one is pure risk. An ideally insurable loss exposure involves pure risk, not speculative risk. And if you remember, we said that pure risk represents the chance of either a loss or no loss, but there's absolutely no potential for gain with a pure risk. That's speculative risk that has the opportunity for gain. Insurance is concerned with pure risk, not speculative risk, the chance of loss or no loss. If you look at our risk quadrants, the two types of risk that represent pure risk were hazard risk and operational risk. Remember, financial risk, strategic risk, those are types of speculative risk. Those are not ideally insurable. If speculative risk was insured, the insurer would have to charge an excessive premium, and the premium would eliminate any expected profits of the insured. So let's say that I'm a real estate developer and I purchase an apartment complex, I can absolutely purchase insurance to insure me from losses from a fire, but I can't purchase insurance to guarantee that I'll have a gain when I sell the apartment complex. I can insure the pure risk, not the speculative risk. And once again, hazard and operational risk represent pure risk. Financial risk and strategic risk represent speculative risk. The second characteristic of an ideally insurable loss exposure is that the loss must be fortuitous, which is either accidental or unexpected. When we're talking about accidental or unexpected, it needs to be accidental from the insured standpoint. In some cases, it's accidental from two different points of view. Some cases, it's accidental from one point of view. For example, if I own a building and someone vandalizes my building, certainly they did that on purpose, but from my standpoint, from my point of view as the building owner, it was accidental, it was fortuitous. And insurance is concerned with it being accidental from the insured's point of view. There are some types of losses that are fortuitous from both points of view, like a fire, weather, storm. Those are accidental from both points of view. Insurance is suitable when there's a reasonable uncertainty about the probability or timing of a loss without the threat of moral or morale hazard. Those threats would include me maybe burning down my own building, arson or something. That's certainly not a fortuitous loss. A third characteristic is that the loss must be definite and measurable. An ideally insurable loss exposure involves a loss that is definite and measurable, definite in time, cause, and location, such as a fire. Theft is also considered definite, but missing inventory, as I said before, without any proof whatsoever that it was stolen, that's not definite. So it needs to be definite and measurable for it to be ideally insurable. Liability policies written on an occurrence basis require the insurer to be able to determine that the event occurred during the policy period. Another characteristic is that there needs to be a large number of exposure units. An ideally insurable loss exposure involves a large number of similar exposure units, like houses. Insurance spreads the risk among a large number of similar exposure units within the same period. The law of large numbers requires that past events occur under the same conditions in the future. And so we need to have a large number of similar exposure units, and that's why in some cases insurers may be unwilling to insure losses arising from emerging technologies because there's no credible loss data. Another characteristic is that the exposure units must be independent and not catastrophic to the insurer. Windstorms, floods, those can be catastrophic. They can wipe out an entire city. And so those are not part of an ideally insurable loss exposure. A multi-million dollar property can also be catastrophic to a small insurer. The insurer also must charge an affordable premium. That's the final characteristic of an ideally insurable loss exposure. This is possibly the most important characteristic of insurance, that it's affordable. Smaller losses or high probability losses are generally uninsurable. Before we move on, though, let's look at our handout. And once again, you don't need to memorize all of this, but let's just take a look here at the ideally insurable characteristics and how they apply to a couple of different loss exposures. If you notice, the first loss exposure listed is fire, and we have a column for each of the characteristics. And if you notice, the first column is that it needs to be a pure risk. Well, clearly a fire is a pure risk. It satisfies that characteristic. Not if it's arson, but other than arson, fire is a pure risk. Is it fortuitous or accidental? And the answer is yes. Once again, not if it's arson, but otherwise fire is accidental. Is a fire definite and measurable? Yes. Are there a large number of exposure units? Well, with a personal residence, a house, absolutely. With a commercial property, there probably are a large number of exposure units, but it really depends on the type of property, the location, the use of the property. Is fire independent and not catastrophic? Yes. And are the premiums affordable? Yes. So fire meets the characteristics of an ideally insurable loss exposure. Let's look at another one. Let's take a look at death. So there's life insurance. Let's look at death. Is death pure risk? Yes, it is. Is death accidental or fortuitous? Yes, except in the case of suicide. Is death definite and measurable? Yes, it is. And is there a large number of exposure units? For personal, yes, but if we're talking about commercial life insurance, like on executives, things like that, it depends on the personnel. So in many cases, yes, there are a large number of exposure units. Is it independent and not catastrophic? Yes. And then are the premiums affordable? Really depends, but in many cases with personal life insurance, the premiums are affordable. So this is an interesting reference as to how different types of loss exposures fit within these categories, these characteristics. But once again, no need to memorize the whole chart. Just look through it to get a feel for how these characteristics and categories work. Before using guaranteed cost insurance, it must be determined if insurance meets the organization's risk financing goals. And we actually have another handout for this one. If you look at the handout where at the top it says risk management goals, the bottom half of that page says ability of retention and transfer to meet risk financing goals. And if you notice, there are five goals listed, five goals of risk financing that are listed here, and those match the goals that we've listed on this slide. So let's go through the five common risk financing goals: paying for losses, managing the cost of risk, managing variability or uncertainty of cash flows, maintaining liquidity, and complying with legal requirements. We'll revisit this in a few minutes, but these are the common risk financing goals. So let's do a practice question. Which one of the following statements is correct regarding characteristics of ideally insurable loss exposures? Private insurance is most suitable when there is a reasonable certainty regarding the timing of a loss. There has to be uncertainty, not certainty, so A is false. Theft is considered a fortuitous loss from the standpoint of the thief. No, it's from the standpoint of the victim, not the thief, so B is false. The insurer can only determine an appropriate premium if the losses are fortuitous or accidental. Absolutely true, C is our answer. D, the probability of a fortuitous loss increases as more policies are written. Losses being accidental have nothing to do with the number of policies written. It's either accidental or it's not. That doesn't get influenced by the number of policies written. So D is false. Once again, C is our answer. Let's talk about some ways of transferring risk without the use of insurance. That's non-insurance risk transfer. Most organizations are parties to non-insurance contracts. That includes leases, purchase agreements, construction contracts. Those contracts may include risk transfer provisions. There are two categories of non-insurance risk transfer we're going to go through. The first one is the transfer for risk control. That would be where I'm transferring the actual loss exposures to another party. One of my loss exposures could be the risk of getting sued. Well, what if I could transfer the risk of getting sued to another party, to where I cannot be sued? That's transfer for risk control, where I'm transferring the actual loss exposure. We also have transfer for risk financing. That's where I'm transferring away the financial consequences of loss exposures to another party. So if it's a transfer for risk financing, maybe I can still get sued, but if I do get sued, somebody else is going to pay for it. Of course, if that somebody else that's going to pay for it is insolvent, then I'm going to have to pay for it myself. There's no protection for me under transfer for risk financing if the party that I've transferred the risk financing to is unable to pay. Let's start off by talking about some non-insurance transfers for risk control. The first one is a lease or a leasing contract or arrangement. Let's say that I own an office building. As an office building owner, one of my loss exposures is that the building catches on fire and burns to the ground. However, if I don't own the building, I'm just leasing one of the offices, I don't have that loss exposure. So as a lessee, I do not have the loss exposure. That's a non-insurance transfer for risk control. The lease transfers the responsibility to the lessor, the owner of the building. There are a couple of situations where a lessee could be responsible for losses. For example, sometimes these lease agreements require the lessee to return the property in the same condition as of the time the lease was started. And of course, in most situations, if I cause harm to others, I'm going to be responsible for that. But one way of transferring loss exposures to another party is by leasing property as opposed to owning it. Waiver is another way of transferring loss exposures to another party. Let's say that you sign a waiver. A waiver is a relinquishment of a right. Let's say that you sign a waiver agreement where you agree to not sue me for a job that I'm doing. You waive your right to sue me for the job that I'm doing. In that case, I'm transferring that loss exposure of getting sued away from myself to you. That can be included in a contract. There's an exculpatory clause, That's a contract provision that excuses a party from liability. We also have contracting for services. That's another way of transferring loss exposures from one party to another. This is commonly called subcontracting, and this is where we are assigning a job to another party, and that generally causes that party to be responsible for losses. The loss exposure can be transferred by contracting with another organization. And finally, we have a disclaimer of warranties. That's another way of transferring a loss exposure to another party. Sometimes when property is sold, the contract will say that it's sold as is. In other words, the buyer cannot come after the seller if there's anything wrong with the property. So the seller is disclaiming all warranties on the property. Let's say I sell you a used car as is, it breaks down 3 days later, you can't come after me in that case. Sellers of property often assert disclaimers by saying that the property is sold as is, may deny any express warranties made during the property's sale. We also have non-insurance transfers for risk financing. That's where somebody else pays for the losses. Those are accomplished through hold harmless agreements. Those are contractual provisions obligating one party to assume the legal liability of another party, and it's included in various types of contracts, including construction contracts, sales agreements, purchase orders, and even lease agreements. The party transferring the financial consequences is the indemnity, and the indemnitor agrees to indemnify the indemnity. There are three classifications of hold harmless agreements, and you need to know these for your exam. Very important. We have limited form, intermediate form, and broad form. And we're going to use in this example a general contractor and a building owner. Those are the two parties of the hold harmless agreement. In this case, the general contractor would be the one that's assuming liability. They're the ones responsible. So they're the indemnitor, also known as the transferee. Under the limited form, the general contractor agrees to indemnify the building owner, but only for the general contractor's own negligence. That's the limited form. So only the general contractor's own negligence makes the general contractor responsible to the building owner. Under the intermediate form, the general contractor agrees to indemnify the building owner for the general contractor's own negligence, of course, as well as both parties' joint fault. So either their own negligence or the joint fault of the general contractor and the building owner. And under the broad form, the general contractor agrees to indemnify the building owner for the general contractor's own negligence, the joint liability for both of them, or the building owner's sole fault. So this is a very broad form because the general contractor is basically agreeing to indemnify the building owner for anybody's negligence. So let's do a practice question. Randall hired a contractor to perform some renovations on his house. When it came time to sign the contract for the job, it included the clause, the contractor agrees to indemnify and hold harmless the owner against claims, damages, bodily injury, or property damage arising out of the contractor's work and caused by any act of omission of the contractor, his agents, and his employees. This is an example of which one of the following forms of a hold harmless agreement. And all the contractor is responsible for is his own work, his own fault, and the fault of his agents, not the joint fault of the contractor and the building owner, not the building owner's sole fault. So when it's just the fault of the general contractor that the general contractor is responsible for, that's the limited form hold harmless agreement. So C is our answer. Let's wrap up module 4 by talking about a special type of insurance, a large deductible plan. Before we actually get into the specifics of a large deductible plan, let's talk first about self-insurance. With a self-insurance plan, the organization maintains a system of paying for its own losses. In other words, the organization is essentially just retaining those losses and paying for it without the aid of insurance. It's a type of alternative risk transfer, a self-insurance plan. It requires claims administration services such as record keeping, adjusting, reserving, litigation management. It's almost as though the organization is becoming its own insurance company. This is well suited for losses paid out over time because it allows for cash flow management, and that would include losses such as workers' compensation losses, general liability losses, and auto liability loss exposures. Those are generally long tail claims because they're paid out over a long period of time. It's often combined with excess insurance, and sometimes that's required by a lot of states. With that said, now let's start talking about large deductible plans. A large deductible plan is similar to a self-insurance plan combined with excess coverage. So let's say that under a self-insurance plan, I'm self-insuring $100,000 of losses. And then for losses over $100,000, I bought an excess insurance policy. That could be one way of setting up my risk transfer plan. Alternatively, I can get a large deductible plan that has a $100,000 deductible. Under both scenarios, I'm still retaining $100,000, but there are some differences between a self-insurance plan with excess insurance and a large deductible plan, even though there are a lot of similarities. One difference between the self-insurance plan with excess insurance and a large deductible plan is that with a large deductible plan, the insurer actually adjusts and pays all claims, even those below the deductible. Remember, with a self-insurance plan, my organization is responsible for all the administration. With a large deductible plan, the insurance company handles all the administration. Even the administration for the first $100,000 loss that I'm going to have to pay for because that's within the deductible. So the way it works with a large deductible plan, let's say that I have a policy that has a $100,000 deductible and $1 million of total coverage, and I suffer a $1 million loss. What's going to happen is the insurance company is going to pay the entire $1 million loss and then bill me for the $100,000 deductible that I'm responsible for. The insurers reimburse for the deductible by the insured. The large deductible itself results in a lower premium, and so this is ideal for organizations that can absorb large losses such as $100,000 or greater. There are several benefits of a large deductible plan. As we just said, lower premiums. That's a major benefit. Also, the reduction of substantial premium taxes, residual market loadings, and insurer overhead and profit charges. Residual market loading, that's an amount charged to make up for losses in a state-sponsored plan to insure high-risk exposures. Another advantage of a large deductible plan is that the organization can benefit from cash flow available on their reserves for retained losses. Remember, what happens when there's a loss, the insurance company pays it and then bills the insured for the deductible. So the insured can pay that deductible over time to the insurance company. Uncertainty can be managed by keeping deductibles at reasonable levels. Those are all benefits of large deductible plans. Earlier in this module, we talked about five different goals of risk financing. Let's take a look at a large deductible plan's ability to meet those goals. The first goal was pay for losses. And a large deductible plan does meet this goal because the insurer pays for losses as they come due. Second and third goals were maintaining liquidity and managing uncertainty, and large deductible plans can meet those goals as long as the deductible is carefully chosen. Complying with regulations is another goal, and large deductible plans meet that goal as well. The last goal of risk financing was minimizing the cost of risk. And a large deductible plan meets this goal better than guaranteed cost insurance because the premiums are less expensive. So let's do a practice question. A high deductible plan may help an organization accomplish which one of the following? Avoid paying substantial premium taxes and residual market loadings. That's absolutely true. A is our answer. decrease the cash flow available on its reserves. Now, if anything, a large deductible plan can help enhance cash flow, so B is false, increase its per occurrence liability and overall cost of risk. These plans generally decrease the overall cost of risk, so C is false. D, reduce its overall loss exposures. That's not really the result of the high deductible plans. They don't reduce loss exposures. They help transfer the risk to another party. So once again, A is our answer. And that concludes Module 4.